This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Coming up, David McCullough has some strong opinions on who is first in flight and some big ideas about what future historians might have to work with. But first, stress is not necessarily a bad thing. It can motivate us, focus our attention, help us meet daily challenges like paying our bills, holding down a job, or caring for our kids. But stress can turn toxic when it's constant and intense, from things like chronic exposure to hunger, substance abuse, and violence, conditions often found in poverty but also experienced by people from all backgrounds. It can especially be bad for young children, leading to biological changes that don't go away. This is Dr. Jack Shonkoff, founding director of the Center for the Developing Child at Harvard University.
Toxic stress is a whole different story. This is the chronic, excessive activation of stress systems. And when it's up most of the time, it has a wear and tear effect on the body. Poor communities, people of color, get chronic illnesses more and have a shorter lifespan, and there's a reason for it. It's not genetic.
But a nurturing adult can protect the child from the debilitating effects of toxic stress if that adult has resources to protect themselves from becoming overwhelmed by adversity. Child First is one of several programs in Connecticut that invests in helping parents nurture children exposed to these stresses at a young age to avoid the high cost of future illness, incarceration, and early death. You can join the conversation, 860-275-7266. Again, 860-275-7266 as we profile this program and talk about other programs like it. You can always go to WNPR.org/where we live to continue the conversation. Find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. Joining us first by phone is Myra Jones Taylor, who's the Commissioner of the Office of Early Childhood. And Commissioner, welcome back to the program. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
A lot of these early child parent programs to deal with toxic stress are home-based, including this one. Why is it important to focus some of these resources on the home?
You know, family support and coaching programs delivered in the home are a proven strategy for strengthening families and are also incredibly cost-effective. When quality programs carried out in local communities are properly implemented, they lead to increased family stability and economic independence, lower rates of child abuse and neglect, lower health care costs, and a reduced need for remedial education. We know, according to the Pew Initiative on Home Visiting, that for every dollar spent on home visiting, we save at least $2 in future spending. You know, in the Connecticut Office of Early Childhood, our goal is to ensure that all children are safe, healthy, thriving, and learning, and ultimately that these children are prepared for success in kindergarten and life beyond. But we know that some children and families face more challenges than others in this pursuit. We know that growing up in poverty makes it more difficult for a child to take full advantage of her natural capacity to grow and learn. And so there are home visitors who come in and make a huge impact on that. We have two types of kind of factors that play a role in the life course of a child. There are these risk factors. These are things that can experiences that have an increased ability to have a negative outcome for a child. And then we also have protective factors like parent resilience and social connections in the community and knowledge of parenting and child development. And these protective factors can actually act as a buffer against the challenges of poverty or substance abuse and violence. And so it's so important that we have home visitors who are in the home, who are working directly with caregivers, where it's a natural environment, where families feel more secure and a little more at ease, to actually work with providers and work with families to prevent or to promote these protective factors.
Do you have a sense of how many children in our state right now would benefit from or currently receive services like the ones you're talking about?
Yes, we have approximately 6,600 children and families who are served by home visiting programs that are operated by the Office of Early Childhood. And then our partners at the Department of Children and Families also have a set of programs where they serve children in greater critical need.
When you talk about evidence-based programs, which is something obviously that you're trying to promote, what exactly you mean? Talk a little bit more about the evidence that is behind programs like this.
Right. You know, we have evidence, and I'm sure Dr. Lowell can talk a lot about this, but the federal government has put out kind of a very high benchmark for what it means to be considered an evidence-based home visiting program. They have to have a randomized control trial. They have to really show that this is, if followed with fidelity, that these programs can make a significant impact in a child's life. So this isn't kind of a willy-nilly feel-good approach. There's real science behind why engaging parents, why talking to them about safe sleep, for example, or attachment, which is something I'd love to talk about about more, is so critical in developing a healthy child. There are 17 model programs that the federal government recognizes, and Connecticut is fortunate in that we have two in this state, which is pretty big. We have Child First and then Minding the Baby, which is out of also out of Yale.
When you say attachment, what do you mean?
So attachment, this is, you know, it's really, it sounds like a big fancy word, but really what it means is that a child has formed secure bonds with the caregivers, the parents in their lives. 85% of a child's brain is developed by the time they are three. And all the things that we want a child to be able to do when they enter school, all the cognitive steps, all the multi-step tasks that we want them to do, they really have a hard time doing those if in the earliest years of life they have not formed secure bonds with their caregivers. And what that means is that they know that the people who are around them are going to protect them, they love them, they're going to have fun with them, but they feel secure that this person or these people are there to support them throughout their lives. And that is, home visitors do so much great work around building that attachment so that we can have children who feel successful in life in general, and then especially when they enter kindergarten.
Commissioner, stand by. I want to bring into the conversation some folks who are here to talk about this specific program that we mentioned. If you want to join us again, 860-275-7266. Dr. Darcy Lowell is founder and CEO of Child First and associate clinical professor at Yale School of Medicine and Pediatrics and at Yale's Child Study Center. Welcome to the program. Thanks so much for being here.
Oh, thank you for having me.
I also want to welcome in Flora Murphy, who's a mental health clinician who works with Child First. Flora, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
In just a moment, we're going to be hearing from a parent of a child who's received some of these services. But first, Dr. Lowell, maybe you can talk about this idea of chronic and intense stress, what the impacts really are on children, and how the program that you have helps to mitigate some of these problems.
Oh, thank you so much. I'd be happy to. What we know about very early development is that when children are exposed to multiple stressors in their environment we're talking about not only poverty, things like domestic violence, substance use, homelessness, maternal depression, which is really one of the major stressors. What we see is the cortisol levels in their bodies and therefore in their brains go up. And we know, as Jack Shonkoff said, that this actually damages the developing brain. And we have an opportunity to prevent that in two major ways. One, we can actually decrease the stress in the environment very directly. And two, as was so beautifully said, the nurturing relationship, a responsive, nurturing, secure relationship has actually been shown to buffer the brain from the effects of those cortisol levels. It actually prevents cortisol from rising. And so Child First is actually based on that, what we call theory of change, that science. And so we have two individuals, two professionals as a team, which work in the home together. And one is a mental health clinician like Flora, who actually do psychotherapeutic intervention with the families. Because our families have had so much trauma and adversity in their lives, and our moms actually, if you look at the studies that we've done, 98% of our moms have had trauma in their lives. Now, there are some who have not, but most of them have. And 80% of our children have had trauma of one sort or another. And what we know is if we can work together, it's called a dyadic or parent-child therapeutic intervention, we can actually prevent this rise in cortisol, and we can develop, we can heal and develop healthy relationships. I just want to say the other part is our care coordinator. So that's about preventing the brain from getting the rise, the effects of the rise of cortisol. But then our care coordinators actually directly help decrease the stress in the environment by connecting families with all kinds of services and supports that they do not have, and which not only decreases the parent's stress or the caregiver's stress and allows them to, you know, take a deep breath and to be much more well-regulated and to pay attention to their children and to play and to really start to build that relationship, but it also enables them to connect to life enhancing. So it may be early care and education for a child, or it might be a literacy program for a parent, or new housing, other things that are also going to benefit that family.
You know, and I want to turn to Floor in a moment and get some of the details about what the work is like on a daily basis. But I think, you know, we've covered this topic of toxic stress, especially its impact on children, on our program before. But I think for a lot of listeners, it still is surprising that what you're talking about is actual changes in the brain that
yes.
can happen because of the effects of toxic stress. I mean, I think that we have maybe an unhealthy divide in our minds about nature versus nurture, right? We're born with a certain brain, and then how we're raised may indeed change a bit of who we are. But we often think of the biological components being things like bad air quality leading to asthma, or lead paint causing some sort of a developmental problem, or something having to do with, poor nutrition causing a kid to grow up poorly. But you're specifically saying that this rise in cortisol, this effect of stress actually changes the brain permanently in some cases to the worse, and you can reverse this in a child just through nurturing. It's a remarkable thing, frankly, to hear.
Right, that you can actually heal. And, you know, it's so interesting that Jack Shonkoff chose the term toxic stress because he really did want to bring the awareness that we think about toxins like lead and alcohol, and everyone says, no, we don't want those to affect our children. But this is probably more important when you talk about population, when you look at how many children are living in poverty and how many children and their families have challenges that are enormous. The other thing we know is, you know, I'm so interested in what you said about nature-nurture because what we know about the interaction between the environment and the genome, if everyone's heard about DNA,
yeah.
But we actually now know that what happens in the environment can actually change gene expression. So you can have great genes, but if you have bad experiences, it's called epigenetic modification. And it's new, relatively new in the literature, but so important for us to remember because we have an opportunity here to make a profound difference.
Flora, I'm wondering if you can take us on the ground here and talk about the work that you do specifically. I mean, what are the interactions like? What are the interventions like with children?
So I think for me, one of the great strengths of Child First is that it's not a manualized program, that we have a tremendous set of skills. Darcy talked about the child-parent psychotherapy, which is an intervention that we use a lot with kids who've had traumatic experiences. It's trauma-informed, so we're working with the parent and child together to use the relationship that the parents have. We talked about the effect of the relationship as a place of treatment. So supporting the parent and the child to make sort of sense of what's happened, to acknowledge for the child that something has happened, and then to support the parent in creating a safe space for them moving forward. It doesn't necessarily, with child-parent psychotherapy, mean that we're going to be able to change exactly what's happening in the home. There are some factors we can't influence. Community violence, we can't have an impact on. Maybe other factors that are happening in the home. But if a child feels that they are supported and understood by a parent, they will do much better. And we talk about how that changes the brain and having a child feel safe. So that's one of the interventions that we use. Another is circle of security parenting, which is an intervention that supports a parent's sense of attachment. We talked about attachment earlier and how important that is. For some parents, they've come out of their own experience of not having their own experience of being nurtured. And so it's a place that we start with the parent to understand what it means to nurture a child because they were not nurtured themselves. And so it's those two. And I think Darcy talks about the care coordination and the clinical together, that any of us who have experienced stress, not toxic stress, but a stressful period in time, know how profoundly difficult it is to think creatively when you are stressed. And we are looking at parents to make a change in their children's lives when they are profoundly stressed, not necessarily by poverty, but by any stress factors. And Cynthia, who's here, will talk a little bit about some of the other stresses that can happen in a life that makes it so difficult to meet the needs of your child because you cannot be creative when you are stressed. Your brain is shut off. So we talk with parents just even about the meaning of stress, about what's happening in their brains, because that's not information that people are receiving. And once they hear that they're being shut down, not because they cannot be or do not desire to be there for their child, but because there's actually things going on in their brain that's shutting them down. So that's a piece of work. And I think a nice illustration of the care coordination is I was working with a parent. We've been working for a while, and she was struggling in some ways. And I had noticed I'd been working with her a lot on her ability to be there for her child. And one day I was noticing with her, I'm like, you seem like you have so much more confidence. And she said, yeah, it's because I have my high school degree now. And this was a support that the care coordination had brought in, had supported her in obtaining her high school diploma. And she just felt that had transferred into a whole sense of who she was and how she could be there for her child. It was a really nice part of Child First. And, I mean, we do work with families who are sometimes at their most challenging point, but I never feel frustrated in this work because this model is really comprehensive. It meets, when you talk about that cliche about meeting people where they're at, we truly do that.
I want to just ask Commissioner Jones-Taylor quickly before I have to turn to a break. Obviously, it sounds as though this is very specialized care, and it is person to person, and it can be fairly labor and time intensive. You mentioned that it is more cost effective to provide these services in home. Can you just give us a little sense about the cost effectiveness of a program that does seem so comprehensive in what it does?
Yes, I mean, so like I said, the Pew Initiative, for example, said that it's you save $2 for every dollar invested. I mean, for us in the Office of Early Childhood, our goal is to make sure children are prepared and that they are thriving and ready for school. And a child cannot do that if they are worrying about their parent or their caregiver. If they feel they go to school and they feel that they're worried about whether or not they're experiencing depression or experiencing violence, we cannot actually ask the same thing we can't ask of adults, all those creative, complicated thoughts. We can't ask that of children if they are not feeling secure with their relationship with their parent. And so if you think about over the lifespan, what that means in terms of special education, what that means in terms of remediation, having that child repeat a grade because they're so concerned about their parents or they're so concerned about the challenges that they face in the home that they can't do the creative, critical work that they need to do in school. That is costing the state far more money than paying up front for these incredibly important home visiting programs.
Myra Jones-Taylor is the Commissioner of the Office of Early Childhood. Thank you so much for your time. I appreciate it.
Thank you. It's always a pleasure.
When we come back, we'll continue our profile of a program called Child First, helping to mitigate some of the effects of toxic stress on children. And we're going to meet a parent who has benefited from some of these services. You can call us at 860-275-7266 if you have questions where we live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Today we're talking about some Connecticut home visitation programs that help parents and children build resilience against toxic stressors that would derail most of us. We're profiling a program called Child First. Dr. Darcy Lowell is here, the founder and CEO of Child First. Also, Flora Murphy, who is a mental health clinician who works with Child First. I want to welcome in Cynthia Gentry, who's a parent who has benefited from some of these services. Cynthia, welcome to our program. Thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
First of all, how did you find Child First, or how did Child First find you?
Through DCF and actually attending also the Circles of Security, which is a parenting class that was recommended by DCF.
What was happening in your house?
What was happening in my house at that time? My oldest son, Noah, he was diagnosed with bipolar, manic depression, ODD, impulsivity control disorder.
How old was he?
He was diagnosed with that back in 2005, but at the time when we came into contact with Circles of Security and Child First, that was back in 2012, so I would say
he was 14.
14, thank you, Flora.
14 or so, yeah, yeah. Okay, so that's an awful lot going on for young men. So how is this playing out in his life, in your life? What problems around this were you dealing with?
Due to the bipolar and Noah's behavior, there was verbal abuse, mental abuse, physical abuse in the home, not just only directed towards me, but also my daughter, who's now 19. And when he couldn't affect my daughter, affect me, he would then act out onto Aaron, which is the child who participated in the Child First program. Mm-hmm. And Aaron was, you know, he was a witness to all that abuse. He was part of that abuse. And he seemed to take on the role of wanting to protect mommy from that, you know, that abuse, whereas I should have been a protector of him. He actually was becoming my protector. And just all of that stress actually spilled over into his schooling and his before and after programs to the point that he was kicked out of daycares, you know. I was putting him in daycares every month. We'd get through the honeymoon period. After that 2 to 3 weeks, he was being removed. In school, it was a struggle for him because now he was displaying learned behavior that he saw at home going on with his older brother. Mm.
So when you first got involved with Child First, tell me specifically what they did, what this interaction was like, and how they were able to help you.
They came into the home, so that was a big plus. Also, they worked around my schedule because I am a single parent. I work full time. So at that point in time when they came in, I was working in New Hartford, so I was actually coming home late. So it wasn't this that I have to leave work early to attend the sessions. They came into the home. Not only in meeting with them was based on how many times I wanted to. So if I was able to meet 5 days a week, they were willing to meet 5 days a week. Child First was also available on the phone. I was probably talking to Flora every day, 2-3 times a day. I was also meeting with Flora just one-on-one with her outside of the sessions with Aaron. And so like I said, Flora became like a family member. She came right in, you know, like I said, in our home where outside of school, the second place where children spend their most time at is in the home.
How did you begin to see changes and some positives after all of this intervention and this work that Flora was doing?
It took about 6 months for Flora to even penetrate, you know, with Aaron. Aaron, like I said, when Flora first started, Aaron had stress tics. He would blink. He would bite his nails down to the quick, to the point that there was so much stress on his nails, they were white. Aaron was taking probably 5 showers a day just to help, relieve the stress, to calm him. He would chew his food and spit it out. He would clear his throat. Aaron would also never put any clothes on. So if there was any point in my time, you can come in my house and he would be butt naked. Mm-hmm. So things like that. In school, he was socially, he was not where he was supposed to be. He had no friends. The kids in school was actually scared of him. They felt that, you know, things that he, like I said, the learned behavior he was experiencing at home, it was spilling over into school. Aaron would get very upset. So, during play at first, if one of the toys would, we like Legos, so we would build Legos. If Legos would fall over, he would just have a pure meltdown, climb up the, just unsafe behavior, climb up the furniture and things like that.
So, Flora, talk about getting at the root causes of what needs to be done here. In this very specific instance, there's so much going on. There's clearly mental health issues, and there's an overwhelmed parent, and there's abuse, and there's a lot of things happening all at once. How do you start, and then where do you go?
One of the most important things in starting is engagement. And the parent has to trust that there is going to be something that's going to be different here. Parents know that there's something wrong. Cynthia is able to tell you what was happening. It's trying to figure out why that's happening. So first we have to establish trust. Cynthia talked about it took 6 months to build the trust, not only of her, but of her son. At that point, he was 4. But he wasn't willing to trust, and she wasn't willing to trust. She'd also had a number of programs in the home for her older son, and so she was used to having programs, but stuff hadn't been working. So established trust, that took 6 months. Child First allows for that kind of time frame, and that's really important, that this work takes time. So established trust, we were meeting one-on-one with Cynthia, and then also in the family dynamic, doing play and just starting to build up trust with Aaron just in play. And then as I was able to sort of establish Cynthia's trust and describe what I was seeing was that this was trauma and this is PTSD and that we need to do trauma work, that this isn't just play work, we need to do trauma work. But Cynthia, the parent has to be ready to go into trauma work, and trauma work is tough because you have to be able to acknowledge a certain amount and then you have to be ready to make a change, and that's deep stuff. And Cynthia was ready, but it takes time and it takes a lot of work. So we did that, and then moving that forward. And it fluctuates. Sometimes I'm meeting with Cynthia alone more, and then I'm meeting the parent-child more alone. And so we're kind of ebbing and flowing as the parent and child are moving forward through the work.
This idea of trauma, I mean, before you started this work with Flora, did you think about it in these terms, that this was childhood trauma that
No.
your kid was dealing with?
No, it actually just become a part of way of life for me in my home because this is what we was experiencing every day. So not to think that it was trauma, no.
Mm. It's hard to sit with that. And that's what toxic stress can be a result of trauma. So linking those two and the impact on the brain and what that does to a child and to a parent.
And obviously, as Flora was saying, you'd have other programs there. This is not the first time somebody had come in, and so this must have been hard. Like, here we go again. How's this going to be different, right?
Correct. I mean, I've had numerous programs come into home, 6 months to a year, unsuccessful. So when another program is introduced to me, and it's like, I'm willing to try anything because we just can't continue to keep going on the way we've been going on for years. So I was willing to try anything. I'm open to anything. So I went in with an open mind and tried to make the best of, you know, what was, you know, given to me.
So, Darcy, I, both of our guests here actually raised something really important. We've got a parent here who's got an open mind and is willing to accept this sort of help and willing to accept an outsider coming in saying, this is like PTSD, this is trauma in your household, which is something not all parents are willing to accept. What about all the parents who aren't Cynthia, right, who aren't ready to accept this? What do you do?
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, it doesn't have to be named in that way. I think that most of the families who we work with don't come in specifically because there has been trauma. They come in because they're worried about their child. They're worried about the child's behavior more than anything else. So many of our children have been expelled from preschool programs, just like Cynthia talked about, or acting out or having tantrums that they just don't know what to do with, or parents who are referred because they have so many stresses in their lives. You know, it can be an infant, even a two-month-old. We might get a referral because mom is depressed and someone has noticed, boy, this mom is feeling so bad, or there's domestic violence in the home, or in the case of DCF, 50% of our families are open DCF cases because there's been abuse and neglect. So we are really listening to what is happening in that specific family, what is unique to that family. And we do a very comprehensive assessment with our family to understand deeply what's going on with the parent in their lives. What are their challenges? What's going on with that child? And I have to stress that we are all about understanding the meaning of the behavior. We're understanding what is its root cause? Where does it come from? What is the child trying to communicate to us? Because behavior is a communication, especially in very young children. And if we can understand that, and if we can, as Cynthia learned, understand, gosh, that's what my child is feeling. That's what's going on. That's why he's acting like that. Then we have this incredible opportunity to heal.
I think when you have a child who's behaving in difficult and terrible ways and you're feeling very stressed, a parent goes to a place of blame. And that's one of the things we want to go in and make sense of, that this isn't about blame. This is making sense of what's happening. And that this child looks the way they do. It makes sense. They've been through hard and difficult times, and this parent has been through hard and difficult times. And so holding that and holding the parent's experience of that, and that this is not about blame. This is, like Darcy said, finding out why this is happening and what we can do now.
And I would say that there is nothing as powerful as a responsive, nurturing relationship. You know, it can't heal everything, but that is such a powerful element in the child's life. It is what is the foundation of not only self-esteem and mental health, but of cognitive development, of executive functioning, the ability to plan, to focus, to organize, and also, we know it protects children when it comes to health as well.
So where are you right now?
Where am I at right now? Better. I'm in a better place than what I was before. I actually, through the Child First program, I learned a lot about myself. And, you know, and that gives credit to Flora, because Flora paid attention. You know, I think, you know, I know Flora sometimes know me better than I know myself. Flora will walk in and not having a good day. Okay, she says, Cynthia, it's all in your face. But like I said, I'm learning to adapt, evolve, and continue to grow with my children. There is no one style of parenting, and it doesn't work all the time. As the child grows and gets older, you know, what may work now for parenting may not work at that time as well. So I just have to, you know, learn to adjust, adapt, and, you know, continue to have my children feel safe. And that's the biggest part, is that safety net. I'm the parent. I'm supposed to protect them versus it being the other way around.
Do you have friends, neighbors, other people you know who now you, because you've been through this, you can see on their face? You know, you see the same signs?
Yes. It's and actually, it's funny, because when I hear people talk about some of the things that's going on in their home with, you know, behavioral mental issues, I do like, oh, you need to look into the Child First program, because this is what worked for me. It was that out of the box therapy versus then all the other therapy programs. It's like by a script. It's by the book. You know, mm-hmm. They set this criteria that's supposed to work for all families. The one thing about Child First is almost as if it was created just for my family, what worked best for my family. For example, you know, all the other programs talk about positive reinforcement or some type of reward system, and implemented all these, just doesn't work. It was a failure, versus where Child First came in with, you know, something different as to how to, you know, realistic rewards. And sometimes with, you know, with my youngest son, Aaron, reward for him is just a hug. That's what makes him happy. He doesn't want a prize. He doesn't want to go somewhere. It's just that simple hug that gives him that sense of security and, you know, that nurturing piece and that connection between me and him.
I just have a little less than a minute left, but I have to ask you, Darcy, this is obviously a very important program. You'd like to be able to extend it more. What are the funding challenges you have right now?
Funding's always a challenge. We are very lucky to be supported both by our Department of Children and Families, DCF, as well as federal funds from home visiting. It's called maternal, infant, early childhood home visiting. But it is – and philanthropy is a major, major part of our funding as well. But it is always a challenge. We're looking for new and creative ways. We are working on Medicaid reimbursement for the work that we do. And we are also working on kind of public-private partnerships to be able to do things in a innovative way.
And we're going to put more information on our website, wnpr.org/where we live, if you want to find out more about Child First. Dr. Darcy Lowell, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Thanks also to Flora Murphy. Thank you for your time. And I want to thank Cynthia Gentry for sharing your story today. Thank you, Cynthia, for coming in.
I really
appreciate it. Coming up next, the great historian David McCullough will talk a bit about who really was first in flight. Also talk about the historians of the future. That's coming up next, Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Coming up on tomorrow's show, it's our weekly news roundtable, The Wheelhouse. I'll be joined, as always, by Colin McEnroe and a team of reporters to recap the week's news from across the state. Hope you can join us. David McCullough is a Pulitzer Prize-winning historian who's famous for his biographies of Presidents John Adams and Harry Truman. His latest book, released today, is called The Wright Brothers. In it, he chronicles the lives of two of this country's most famous inventors and the lasting legacy of their work. He also has strong opinions about Connecticut's claim to being first in flight, which we'll hear about in a moment. McCullough will be speaking at the Connecticut Forum this Saturday alongside another author and historian, Stacey Schiff. You can find out more at ctforum.org. David McCullough joined us by phone. Welcome to Where We Live.
Thank you.
First, I'd like to ask why you decided to write a book about the Wright brothers. What was missing from the history that that you wanted to tell, that you wanted people to know about them?
When I finished my last book, The Greater Journey, about those Americans who went to Paris to improve their abilities in medicine, art, architecture, literature, and so forth, I had a great urge to go on. My focus there was strictly on the 19th century. And I wanted to move on into the 20th century, so I began doing a little research and reading about various characters who went to Paris or to France for purposes other than having a good time or improving their social position, not including those who've been so often done, Hemingway, Gertrude Stein, and so forth. And among the people I was very surprised to find whose time in France was of immense importance to them and to their achievement, were the Wright brothers. So I realized that I didn't know very much about the Wright brothers, and the more I read, the more fascinated I became, and it wasn't long before it dawned on me that this is the book I want to write. It's been, for me, one of the most revealing and fascinating projects I've ever worked on.
How so? Why so revealing?
Well, because I found that the usual picture that people have of the Wright brothers were a couple of Ohio bicycle mechanics who got lucky and invented the first airplane. Yes, they were bicycle mechanics, and yes, they were from Ohio, but it wasn't just luck, and they did much more than invent the airplane. They learned to fly it, and it was through an enormous number of setbacks and disappointments and near tragedies that they persisted no matter what. But also that they were infinitely interesting as human beings in that they had such intellectual curiosity. They were very steeped in art, music, architecture. They read an enormous amount. They were superb writers. Well, Wilbur was a superb speaker. Orville was a little too shy to speak much in public. And that their family life, including most especially the part played by their sister Catherine, was so new to me, so refreshing in its very human side that I knew right away this is what I want to do. And most importantly, I guess, would be to tell you that in a huge collection of letters, private letters, family letters, correspondence, diaries that have been at the Library of Congress all these years, and number well over 1,000 items.
You said that one of the things that got you so excited was these people as people, not just as the inventors and flyers of this airplane. Maybe
that's right. If they had failed in their project, I would still want to have written the book because it's such a human story. You play with four characters, oh, I guess five or six because there were some supporting characters of immense interest and importance.
Tell us a bit about what you learned about their relationship and the people as people, Orville and Wilbur, as opposed to just the Wright brothers who we always think of as just these two who did this one thing. Tell me about who they were as people and what their relationship was like.
Well, they were the sons of a itinerant minister, Bishop Milton Wright, and they had two older brothers who had moved on with their own marriages and personal life, didn't no longer lived at home, and then they had the youngest sister, Catherine. Wilbur, I think, was without any question a genius, the kind of person who's just rarely comes along and had a mind infinitely beyond the normal. Orville was very clever, very inventive, but Wilbur was the leader. He was the big brother. He was the older brother, but literally the two heads were better than one. They were not alike. People said they were identical twins. Well, they weren't. They were unidentical twins. Orville was shy. He could be moody. He did not, as I suggested, like to have any public life. Both of them tried to avoid the limelight as much as possible. They were too busy. They had this mission, this goal that they were determined to achieve. So they screened out an awful lot that life is usually involved with. They never married. They never had families other than their own that they grew up in. They grew up in a house that had no running water, no indoor plumbing, no electricity, no telephone, but it was full of books. And from the time that they were very small, they read all the time and they read all kinds of things because their father insisted that they don't have closed minds. Neither of them ever finished high school, but yet they had as rich and as diverse a liberal arts education as one could hope to achieve. And they did it all on their own. They did everything they did on their own. They had no money to speak of. They had no political connections. They had no foundation supporting them, no university supporting them. They would not give up. Much of what I've written about in my working life has been about people who wouldn't give up. George Washington in 1776, Harry Truman, the builders of the Brooklyn Bridge, the builders of the Panama Canal, where setbacks and hardships and humiliation happen again and again, but they don't quit. They keep on going, and then eventually they succeed, much to our advantage, much to the betterment of the world.
We're talking with David McCullough, the Pulitzer Prize-winning historian and author of a new book called The Wright Brothers. He'll be at the Connecticut Forum this upcoming Saturday, and you can find out more information at ctforum.org, and you're listening to Where We Live. You mentioned a character in your book who is often overlooked, their younger sister, Catherine. Can you talk about her role and relationship with the rest of the family?
Yes, their mother had died when they were still in high school, teenagers, and she was the woman of the house, and she could more, a home of three men, father and two brothers, and she could more than hold her own. She was very bright, tiny little woman, only about 5'1", and opinionated and sociable. She had a temper. She could get wrathy, as she said, but she was always there when they needed her, and she very often kept them on the right track. She made sure that they behaved in a variety of ways as they should. And they had wonderful sense of humor, all three of them. And it comes through in their letters. It comes through in their diaries. Again, of course, we don't keep diaries anymore. We don't write letters. And to enter into the private lives of such remarkable people is a privilege and infinitely interesting. It's like reading a great novel, only it's all real and recorded. They set it down on paper.
One of the things that is so important to their story is the clear documentation of what they were doing. They had a camera with them at Kitty Hawk to photograph what happened. The fact that they photographed this moment David McCullough, do you think that this is what changed history, the fact that they were so good about chronicling what they were doing as it was happening? Because this may have happened, and without the photographs, it may have changed history.
The photographs were their way of keeping records, and they were also, of course, protecting themselves against patent violations. And the peculiar and almost unbelievable aspect of the story is that though they flew their first flight ever, Orville flew the first flight ever in 1903, it wasn't until 1908, 5 years later, that the world was willing to admit that man could fly, that these brothers had done it. They were just dismissed as a couple of crackpots and loonies, nuts. And people in Dayton, including newspaper reporters, wouldn't even go the 8 miles out to the cow pasture where they were demonstrating what they had invented. So it wasn't until they put on a demonstration, Wilbert put on a demonstration in France at Le Mans, that the world suddenly realized it's happened. Man can fly in a motorized machine. And, of course, it changed the world. Last year at one airport in this country, 70 million people came in and out of that airport as passengers on the airplanes at O'Hare Field in Chicago. And everybody just takes it for granted. And yet, Orville Wright, who was the man who flew the first flight ever, lived on until 1948. I could have known him. I would have been 15 in 1948. He could have been the nice old fellow around the corner. Unbelievable that history changed that much, that fast, from one invention. Nothing like it had ever happened before.
Well, because he lived to 1948, what was his thoughts about how far we had come even by then? Of course, by 1948, we were flying as a nation, and obviously air power had been used quite extensively in two great wars. What were his feelings on how far, both for good and bad?
Wilbert died much too soon. He was still in his 40s in 1912, so he never saw the wars. But Orville felt obliged to speak his mind about it and to speak for his brother, too. He was appalled by it all. Who wouldn't be? Of course he was. But he said it's not unlike the invention of fire. You can either use it for positive purposes, useful purposes, essential purposes, or you can use it to destroy and to kill and to ravage a countryside or a city. It was not all happy days are here again. It brought some of the greatest horrors man has ever seen. But nonetheless, here we are sailing along, millions of us at 35,000 feet, thinking, oh, this is just part of life. This is the way it's always been. Nothing to think is anything very particularly unusual. And, of course, it is about as unusual as anything could be have been imagined, particularly back then.
Since we are here in Connecticut, and since I know that you'll get questions about this when you're at the Connecticut Forum, I must ask you about someone who gets a paragraph in the epilogue. His name is Gustav Whitehead. Now, here in Connecticut, there's been legislative action declaring that it was indeed Whitehead and not the Wright brothers who were the first in flight. You write, the story was entirely without evidence and wholly untrue, but kept drawing attention as the years passed to the point where Orville finally felt obliged to denounce it himself. What can you tell us about your thoughts on Gustav Whitehead as first in flight?
Just what I wrote in the book, there's no evidence for it whatsoever. It comes to the fore, this story, this belief, this claim, about once every 25 years. But this always happens. There are people today still who don't believe that man landed on the moon, that it was all faked on television and so forth with special effects. There are people who think that Oswald didn't kill Kennedy. It just, these things keep coming back for some reason or other. And furthermore, it wasn't just that the Wright brothers flew first. They invented the plane that they flew, which wasn't a practical plane in 1903. It couldn't bank and turn. So they spent another 2 years developing the first practical airplane, which was done at Huffman Prairie, as it's called, outside of Dayton, by the Wright brothers. And that was really the birth of the real airplane. But they learned to fly it. And Mr. Whitehead is never known to have flown anything. And when he tried to demonstrate later on, it didn't work at all in front of people. There's something like, I don't know, 35 noted historians, aviation specialists, who signed a statement saying that it's an interesting story, but there's nothing to support it.
Before I let you go, sir, I'd like to ask about the work that you do and how being a historian has changed over the years. You referenced the countless letters that you've been able to source for a book like this or your other books of history. Has something changed about telling historical stories as we change the way we communicate and we change what we leave behind?
That's a very good question and something I think about a great deal. I don't think we've ever had a period where so many first-rate writers are writing history and biography as we're in right now. The reach of these books is enormous, which is a measure of how well they're written. It's also a measure, I think, of a need to know more than we do because we've slipped badly behind in how we're educating ourselves in our schools and universities and colleges in history. 80% of the colleges and universities in the country don't require any history at all in order to graduate. And as a consequence, we've been producing for quite a while people who are basically historically illiterate. They want to catch up. So these wonderful books are coming along, and they're filling a big need. Also, history is opening up more. There's financial history and literary history and technological history, medical history. The part women have played in history is getting attention long overdue. And thank goodness for all of it. The ways in which the past can be evoked in photography. You were talking earlier about how the Wright brothers photographed their whole careers, in effect, and all their accomplishments step by step. Well, that wasn't possible before photography, and now more and more people are realizing how much is to be learned just by simply studying photographs and old films. It's exciting. It's also a little worrisome because if we don't write letters and don't keep diaries, nobody in public life would dare keep a diary anymore because they can be subpoenaed and used against you in court. But if we're not keeping those diaries, we're not writing the letters, what material are future historians going to have to work with?
Yeah, and that's really my question. As you imagine a David McCullough 50 years from now trying to write about Barack Obama, you think of a world filled with tweets and emails that can be, as we've seen recently, erased or kept on a private server.
Exactly.
I mean, what do you think the future historian will look to be able to piece together the story of these people?
This is a huge concern with the people at the Library of Congress, I know, and they are studying ways in which they can preserve the electronic communications of our time. But I have my doubts about that. As you've just said, that someone can very inconspicuously and conveniently for them erase whatever they don't want to have hanging around. It's too bad. I tell people, if you have any interest in immortality, start keeping a diary and write in it every day. And when you feel that your time on Earth is about to wind up, give it to the Library of Congress or some local library or archive. It'll be quoted forever and ever because it'll be the only one in existence. There's an old expression about working your thoughts out on paper. And many people in the days gone by were raised that put your thoughts down on paper, whether it's in a diary or a letter, and it'll help you to clarify your thinking, help you to exercise your mind in a more focused fashion. And it's true. It works. We've all known that. Writing concentrates your thoughts in a way nothing else does. It's good for you, particularly good if you want to improve yourself intellectually or in some particular form of self-expression or achievement.
David McCullough is a Pulitzer Prize-winning historian. He's the author of a new book called The Wright Brothers and, of course, many others. He's going to be part of the Connecticut Forum this Saturday, and you can find out more information at ctforum.org. David McCullough, it was a pleasure speaking with you. Thank you so much, and have a good time during your trip to Connecticut.
Thank you. I look forward to it very much. I love Connecticut.
Where We Live is produced by Betsy Kaplan, Tucker Ives, Lydia Brown, and Kyone Wolf. Our digital editor is Heather Brandon. The executive producer is Katie Talarski. I'm John Dankosky, and this is Where We Live.